Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu. Welcome to the Kudzu Vine. I'm your host, Steve McLaughlin. Joining me as always,
Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
Feedback.
Yes, I'm getting it. I'm not now. Now you're okay.
Who knows on this? I tried something new, and I'm probably gonna cut that off.
And see what happens, and maybe to get better, because I can't function and think. Well, as you notice from the top of the show, it's just Tim and I. Catherine's a little under the weather, so for the first 20 minutes of this July 26, 2015, you can tell how discombobulated I am. I didn't even put the date on, the date stamp on the thing. It's just going to be the two of us. Then about 7:20, one of our longtime guests has come on three times for us. David Mark is going to join us. We're going to talk a lot of national politics when David comes on. He has been writing at his website, DavidMark, I believe it's .org. He'll tell us for sure the articles he's written for Christian Science Monitor and others, and we're going to go over all that. But in the meantime, Tim and I have some more, you know, single southern state topics. And the first one, Tim, I wanted to talk about was Louisiana. A poll came out, and it was reported on the Bayou Buzz, and I think Political Wire also picked up on it. And it had an interesting finding. It showed if the race were today, and this is that what they call jungle primary, everybody runs on one ballot, that the leading candidate would be John Bel Edwards, the Democratic candidate. And then the Republicans, and there are three of them, would run second, third, and fourth. Also, David Vitter is showing that he's slipping, Paul, because he had led before, but Public Service Commissioner Scott Angeline and Lieutenant Governor Jay Jardine, Vitter doubles Jardine up, and he's 10 points ahead of Angeline, so he's doing quite well to be the Republican nominee, which is pretty important. Tim, first thing, how excited should John Bel Edwards be about this poll?
I wouldn't be very excited at all. He's just about the point that Mary Landrieu was in the jungle primary, around 30%, and when she was leading. And, you know, I sort of figured the other three would split the GOP vote up, and he might finish first. But I don't think that's going to do any good, because those three behind him total 50% with 20% out, which means he would have to get every vote of the undecided vote to win. And, you know, let's face it, that's not going to happen. The important thing down there is to get the Republican nomination. What would be interesting would be if somehow Vitter was denied the Republican nomination, because the whole establishment of the Republican Party has already jumped on his ship for various reasons that we've discussed on here. And so that's the thing to watch now, to see if Vitter holds on. This is one poll. I think Vitter is going to hold on. I think he's going to be the Republican nominee. And I'm still thinking he's going to win by 15 to 20 points later this year. But, you know, Edwards is doing the best that he can, I think, under the circumstances. And I'm glad he's the lone Democrat in the race.
Yeah, I agree that, you know, he shouldn't bet any money on this thing, all that. But I will tell you some bright spots. One, he's the same spot that Mary Landrieu was. Well, Mary Landrieu was a multi-term incumbent. Probably we're starting to kind of find a Democratic base there, obviously. But if you got to think, well, if nobody knows him and maybe some people meet him and they decide they like him,
then maybe he can do a little better than her. Also, it mentions that it was very, her race was very presidential heavy. You know, he wouldn't be running in a federal race, so maybe people would start to see that the state race is different than the federal race. That could help him. Another thing, it does show that Vitter is unpopular, and there is a chance, I would think, that Vitter gets the nomination and Angeline and Jay Dardenne's supporters, a small percentage, not a big percentage, but a small percentage would say, we just are repulsed by Vitter and his personal scandals, and we're going to vote for the Democrat anyway. That probably doesn't get him to 50, but it gets him to over 30. It's not like he's going to, I would think he would stay at 30 then in the general election. I mean, he would move up hopefully into the 40s at least, still lose, but it'd be a more competitive race than some may look at it now. And that's kind of the best case scenario.
Yeah, it is. I'm going to hold it a 15 to 20 point race. I think, even though he can't win, I don't think losing, say, 57-3 would be probably delightful news to the Democratic Party in the nation as a whole when they're looking at the national race next year or something like that. The problem with the Democratic base in Louisiana is it's trying to build back up from the ravages of that hurricane where, you know, half the base left the state and did not return.
And if they did return,
trying to replace people that are not there.
And if they did return, they may not have registered back to vote because they're still kind of getting things set up, and, you know, just a lot of factors there. Now, one more thing before we get to the presidential side of this poll, but it kind of segues us there. How much of a drag do you think that Bobby Jindal is on the three Republican candidates?
Well, probably not so much on Vitter, because he and Vitter do not like each other. There is nothing that Bobby Jindal would love more than to see David Vitter get beat. They have bumped heads on more than one occasion. They don't personally like each other. And so I don't think it would hurt Vitter at all. Matter of fact, if the fact that he and Jindal have bumped heads is probably very helpful to him at this point. He can coalesce not only an anti-Democratic vote, but an anti-Jindal vote too, one of those in-your-face kind of votes. So I think it's a two-edged sword that's going to help him. And Governor Jindal, if he's a drag, he's a drag on the other candidates, especially his lieutenant governor. Because, I mean, this was lieutenant governor. So.
Yeah, well, I mean, but they don't run as a ticket in Louisiana.
But they got offices in the same building. When people think of the administration, they put them both in there together. Aren't you a little surprised that the lieutenant governor is not running a better race? Because he's got some profile in the state. He's run statewide races. You know, he's been on television a lot, presiding for some reason over their, you know, state senator or whatever.
If he were trailing, it's who he's trailing. If he were trailing the other U.S. senator, if he were trailing a congressman, an attorney general, he's trailing a PSC member. Unfortunately, I think a lot of states, they don't even know what the PSC is.
Right.
PSC members are not well known, for good or bad.
They don't get elected to higher office in Georgia, you know. They generally, when they get to the PSC, that's about as far as they ever get.
Well, in higher office, you could then switch over to another, like agriculture, insurance, that kind of thing. And then from there, you could build up to something with higher profile.
But
you don't go from there to
In so many states, the lieutenant governor's job, it exists really as a launching pad to the governor's chair. It's happened a lot all over the country. It used to happen a lot in this state. but this doesn't seem to be happening. Now, Jen, when Vitter got in the race, it was, you know, I'm surprised it is just 10 points between him and the next guy.
Yeah, Lieutenant Governor, if you don't want to work, but want to see your name on the ballot, probably the best job in politics. Well, let's get into that presidential side of things in Louisiana, because I don't think Louisiana is a state that's going to get polled a lot because it's not early in the primaries. And I don't think if Louisiana is in play at the presidential level, then it's pretty much a wipeout in the general. But right here, Bobby Jindal, you'd think he'd run pretty well. He's running fourth, and that's tied for fourth with Ben Carson. He's behind Scott Walker, who's first with 23%, and I think this is noteworthy. Donald Trump is second at 13. Donald Trump's 10 points behind. Now, this poll's a little older, so that may factor into why Trump's 10 points behind. Jeb Bush is third with 9%, and then Jindal and Carson are tied, and I'm trying to find their percentage.
There's another thing too. This is a Jindal internal poll. It was done of the state of Iowa, not of the state of Louisiana.
Oh, okay. I saw them by the buzz.
That's why they made the big splash. Jindal is searching in Iowa. Well, according to this polling, he's gone from about 4% where he's been running, and that's been his best poll up there, to 8%. If you want to call that a surge. Secondly, this is an internal poll. You know how those get, those commissioned by the campaign. And I'm going to tell you, and the best thing to do is show him tied for fourth at 4%. Or at 8% rather with Carson, and I don't know more belief he's at 8% than this yellow wall in front of me is white. The latest polling I've been seeing out of Iowa had him way down below 5% and actually shows Trump pulling up on Walker.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, I actually said, Jindal, I think he doesn't even make the top 10 cut. I'm not even really surprised.
No.
I think people wonder why he's running, because if you can't make that top 10 cut and you are a governor, I mean, a real office, that's kind of sad. Speaking of Carson, Carson gets mentioned in this poll. Carson continues to do well in the polls, and nobody ever says anything about him. I mean, he ain't getting talked about since Trump made his surge. I never see Ben Carson's name mentioned in any way, shape, form, or fashion. Yet when you do see the polls, he's kind of top five in all the polls. I mean, he's not in any danger of winning this thing, but he's not falling apart considering he's getting zero earned press.
Yeah. I think he's got a, should we say, devoted following. I've actually seen some Carson signs in Floyd County down there where you're from.
And that was been a while. But yeah, it's
but you know what? He stuck at 8 to 10% case scenario, and that's as far as he's gonna go. Pretty good for a guy that's never held public office before in a field of 16 guys, most of whom have held a very high public office and have high name recognition to go with it. But I'm not going to say he's the Herman Cain of this year, because he's smarter than Herman Cain ever thought of being. But he's one of this year's hardcore activist type candidates. The Tea Party flavor folks, some of them that are splitting their vote up right now, and he's going to get that all the way through. The thing is, can he get his hands on enough money to stay in this race? Because if he could, he'd probably go to every state and get 8 or 10% of the vote. Don't you think?
Yeah, have some delegates. Obviously, in the way the Iowa caucus works, you know, if you're
sometimes if you're people start dropping out and then you pick up their percent at the caucus or their votes, or you can broker your votes. It'd be interesting to see what happens there. I just noticed that he really is not getting any press whatsoever. I mean, there's so many candidates. No. Obviously, there are people that aren't going to get any. And he hadn't gotten any commensurate with his poll numbers.
He's also not one of these big, big talkers. You know, yak, like Trump. Trump's just sucking the air out of the room. And what press the other candidates are getting would be if they're arguing with Trump, like Graham is, or like Walker is starting to do, or like Bush is, or Rick Perry jumped on that immediately, trying to position himself up, because the last poll I saw, you know, the cutoff is at 10 for that debate. Well, he was 11th. Well, you know, they're trying to position themselves to get in that top 10. And attacking Donald Trump might be a way for some of them to do it.
Oh, yeah, it was real funny. Donald Trump thought about Lindsey Graham's intelligence and said, yeah, I don't even think he's as smart as Rick Perry. I was like, well, that's a real compliment to Rick Perry, to phrase it that way. Speaking of Rick Perry, did you see his latest response? He says, we should be able to take our guns to the movie theaters. Does he not realize that they turn the lights out in the movie theater? Even if you're a good shot, how are you going to see? We're going to see night goggles.
How are you even going to know what's going on? I mean, who are you going to shoot when there's 200 people in there? That's just what we need, a Wild West show. But that,
well, and,
you know, I'm giving up, really, Dave, talking to people about guns. It just don't seem to be any point in it. Did you notice, by the way, that Chris Christie, of all people, ripped into gun rights activists? And he did it out there in Iowa at a town hall. Some guy questioned his commitment, shall we say, to the Second Amendment. And the guy got in the guy's face and said, you know, I'm waiting for one fact from you about me being anti-gun. If you give me one fact, or you know how confrontational Christie is. And so I was wondering, why are the guns rights people going after him?
Probably because of where he's from. I mean, New Jersey's just a state where, you know, probably a larger percentage of population is wants stricter gun regulations. So therefore, he probably isn't as, you know, gun crazy as a lot of his counterparts in the primary. I guess he could corner that niche in the Republican Party. I don't know in the primary electorate how many votes that gets him, but he could corner it, I guess, for what good that is. But, you know, you go into a movie theater. It's an action movie. They're shooting in the movie. The shooting's coming from that surround sound. I mean, I guess you couldn't use that to help locate your target.
This is how long their memories are. What they're mad at him about, he attacked an opponent that ran against him up there in New Jersey for trying to repeal the assault rifle ban that they have in that state. Well, that happened in 1995, 20 years ago. That's how long their memories are with any politician that says anything negative about him. If you say something 20 years ago, it comes back to bite you.
Yeah.
That's what it's all about.
Yeah, I mean, that's their single issue. They know it right, you know, top to bottom. Well, I'd like to welcome onto the show, back to the show for the umpteenth time, David Mark. Welcome, David.
Hey, David. Good to be back with you.
Yeah, you're on with Tim and I. Catherine's a little under the weather today. But David, I want to start off with a quick little story from the last time you were on. You were on, I guess, late winter, early spring with us, and you had a interview coming up, I think, later that night on C-SPAN, and so I recorded that interview and watched it, I believe, the next day. My daughter sees it, and she's like, why are you watching this channel, Daddy? You know, she's 11. She doesn't know a lot about C-SPAN, but she knows it's not really interesting for an 11-year-old. She's like, why are you watching this boring channel? And I explained to her why I'm watching your interview. This guy was on my podcast, author, da-da-da-da-da, you know, trying to sell you and all. And she swatches a little bit, and she goes, this is still pretty boring, but the fact that you had a guy on national TV must mean your podcast is better than I thought. So, David, I really got to thank you for helping, you know, the podcast and myself in the eyes of my daughter since you were on TV, even if it was a boring channel in her eyes.
Yeah, listen, I have adults who say the same thing into the boring channel. So your daughter's on to something there.
Yeah, hey, that could be a job so I could get. Try to make C-SPAN more appealing to preteens. you could work for the rest of your career. Plenty of work.
They're good folks over there at C-SPAN. They're true to their mission. They're dedicated to publicizing public events, and they do a good job. It's a niche audience, so shall we say.
Yeah. Well, I thought I'd share that anecdote since, you know, my daughter happened to see you, probably the only time she'll watch C-SPAN in the next few years, we'll say. Unless you come on again and you tell us about it, and then I'll record it and watch it again. She'll be like, hey, same old guy from last time. So,
No appearances planned at the moment, but I'm sure there'll be some soon enough.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's get into some of these issues. And something that hadn't been, no one could describe as boring, is Donald Trump's entry into the presidential race. You know, it's what everybody talks about, no matter where on the political spectrum. David, what's kind of your thoughts looking at this thing?
Well, it's interesting. He's gone now through three or four of the Republican presidential candidates, insulting them in various ways, whether it's Jeb Bush, John McCain, Lindsey Graham, Scott Walker, the Wisconsin governor, was his latest. So he's got 10 or 11 more to burn through, and I think this is going to wear thin after a while, in that the shock value is going to wear off. He's going to have to keep one-upping himself. So I think he might be peaking too early. He might be better off, might have been better off doing this in December and into January, right before the primaries. I just don't know at a certain point if there's going to be much to say about these folks.
Yeah, I think we had some discussion last week after the comments against John McCain, or what was it, even 2 weeks ago, Tim? I'm trying to remember. But we, you know, it's been at least one show in between, and we kind of felt that that would hurt him. We didn't know how much. And the polls came out today. An NBC poll came out, a CNN poll, both show him leading. They don't show a lot of flack from those comments. David, are you surprised that the John McCain comments did not cause more of a backlash in the polls?
Not at all, because that's the kind of political opponent that these other Republicans really have to fear. Somebody who's not afraid to go down swinging and say anything. And when somebody has nothing to lose, that's really dangerous to be up against. I don't agree. Obviously, I don't agree with Mr. Trump's characterization of John McCain's record at all. I think it's a pretty awful thing to say. But there is a large block of people out there, really across the aisle, people who just are fed up with politicians, and they don't care about the nuances, the niceties, decorum of politics. They like people who get in there, rough it up, and want to shake up everything. And that's what Donald Trump is appealing to. That's been his career. And so I'm not surprised at all. Now, again, I think that's going to wear thin after a certain point, but he's probably going to rise further before he falls.
Yes. Well, I'm going to pass that over to Tim. Tim, you can ask more about Donald Trump, or you can move on to other candidates.
Good evening, Mr. Mark. Thank you for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
I do have to ask this. You say you believe that Trump will rise a little further before he falls. Well, then pretty much we can pencil Donald Trump in for the first debate, right?
Oh yeah, he'll probably be in first place for when the debate comes in to get into the top 10 slots there. Whether he'll be able to perform at the debate or not is another question, because he won't have a free microphone the way he does now.
Mm-hmm. 4 years ago, you know, we were seeing a flavor of the week, seemed like, in the Republican field. This candidate got popular. That insurgent got popular. And as quickly as they flamed up, they flamed out.
Yeah.
When Trump does start to fade, is he going to fall precipitously, or is it just going to be a gradual thing, do you think?
Well, the thing to note about Trump is he's got a lot of money he could spend on this race, unlike some of those other folks that you were alluding to, like Michelle Bachmann or Herman Cain, Rick Santorum, et cetera. Donald Trump, while he doesn't necessarily have unlimited funds, he's pretty wealthy, but he's not the richest guy out there, but he can spend an awful lot on his campaign and stay in there for a good amount of time. So I think that by itself suggests that he's got some staying power here. He's also just got a bigger megaphone, you might say, than those other candidates last time around. Herman Cain, Michelle Bachmann, yeah, they had the reasons why people followed them for a while, but Donald Trump is an internationally known business guy, and people listen to, rightly or wrongly, people listen to what he has to say. So I think he's got longer staying power than those other ones.
I'm going to ask you one more question, and then I'll pass it back to David to take us on down the road here. And you mentioned money. And
yeah,
we know now that unlimited money is pretty much the rule of the day in national politics because of the Supreme Court's decisions. With unlimited money now the rule of the day, a candidate could, with one or two big benefactors, let's say, stay in the race for a much longer time than would have been possible in the past, even 4 years ago. And we got 16 candidates now running on the GOP side. With those two dynamics in place, the unlimited money and the amount of candidates, can we seriously start looking at the possibility of maybe a brokered convention next year?
I think it's unlikely, just the way the party structures and primary systems are set up at this point. For one thing, some of these candidates are not going to make it even to early primary voting. You look at perhaps Ben Carson or George Pataki, Jim Gilmore, some of these other folks, maybe even Rick Perry, the former governor of Texas, they just may not have the money, support, et cetera, to stay in the race. So I think we're going to see the field whittled down at that point. Also, the further you go on after voting actually occurs in Iowa, South Carolina, New Hampshire, down the line, that's going to whittle down the race more. It just, to lead to a brokered convention, you would need a really fractured field in which no candidate could claim a majority of delegates, and I think that's going to be difficult to do. It's not impossible, of course, but I think the both parties have set it up in such a way, you might say, rigged the system so that that kind of thing doesn't happen, because that's the worst nightmare for one of these political parties. So possible, but I think unlikely.
Absolutely, it would be nightmarish. And with that, I'm going to throw it back to David.
Yes. Well, let's kind of talk about a candidate that's on the opposite end of the spectrum, a guy that hadn't got a lot of attention but has a good resume. I've been in the House of Representatives, been a governor of a state that the Republicans kind of almost have a must-have to win the presidency, and that's Ohio, and John Kasich. How do you see his campaign unfolding thus far?
Yeah, I've long been bullish on John Kasich, the governor of Ohio. I think he's somebody who has not gotten as much attention because he's entering later. He probably won't even be in the first debate, ironically, which is being held in Cleveland, his own backyard, his own state. But he's somebody who's got a pretty interesting track record and personality, et cetera. He, before becoming governor of Ohio, winning in 2010, he served in Congress for 18 years. He was elected at a relatively young age. He was budget committee chairman. He oversaw the balanced budget. He's also got a somewhat unique personality in politics. He's somebody who talks off the cuff, so kind of, you might say, shoots his mouth off a bit. He's very religious. He can probably help do well with social conservatives. He can talk up that portion of the coalition. So I think he's actually somebody to watch. I would not rule him out at all, and I can actually see him being one of the finalists. If nothing else, he might be vice presidential material because of the state of Ohio, where he's obviously quite popular.
Yeah, it's such a large field. Let's kind of go, I want to go to an overarching question. You know, they decided that, and I guess it was Fox News since they're hosting the first debate, that they couldn't have, I don't even know how many candidates it is, but it's obviously in the teens. They couldn't have all these candidates on there, so they had to have some type of cutoff. And so they made the number 10, and they're cutting former and current and no telling who other governors, you know, out of this thing most likely. The only female candidate will likely not make the top 10. What's your opinion of that system that Fox is using?
It's unfortunate. I kind of understand it. I don't like it. To me, I'd like to see all the candidates up there. To me, there's, I believe, 16 Republican candidates in the field. I'd love to see four debates of four candidates each. That would be a manageable stage, because it's not just a matter of being fair who gets in, but who actually gets to say something. Now, I know why Fox doesn't want to do that. It's valuable advertising time. They probably lose money on these debates because they could have other programming on that would be more lucrative in terms of selling advertising. I'd love to see some way to divide up this field evenly and pair them off. I would actually kind of do it like the NCAA basketball tournament, where you have the highest seeds and the lowest. So that you have like Donald Trump at the top and George Pataki near the bottom. And so you have some sense of the underdog can still beat the big guy or woman with Carly Fiorina there. I don't know that they'll do that, but it would be one approach to it.
But they could, I guess, draw them out of a hat, kind of like the World Cup does the polls, either one. But, you know, to get advertising, if they did four debates, they could get them sponsors, like, you know, gold coins and I've fallen and I can't get up what is it, the jitterbug phones. You know, they could really, you know, find four products that target their demographic audience really, really well. And cater to that.
That's one approach there. I think the overarching question, though, is how much these debates are really going to matter in terms of making up people's minds. My sense of it is, just with experience reporting over the years, that over in New Hampshire, Iowa, South Carolina, et cetera, people still want to meet the candidate, see them up close, and it's really hard to break through in these debates. So even if they're one of the candidates who get cut out, like if it's Bobby Jindal or Rick Santorum, I still think they have the chance to go out and make their case in terms of retail politics, one-on-one with voters.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to ask another question, then I'm going to pass it over to Tim to ask a few if he wants to, and we'll keep going back and forth. On this Republican field, since there's 16 candidates, we can't take them one by one. If not, who's leading the polls? Because obviously we can do the math there. But just looking at who's run the campaign and who has the best future prospect, if this was like one of those IntelliShares betting situations, who should people put their money on that's positioned themselves well to, you know, exceed expectations and possibly even win this thing, the nomination?
I'd go back to John Kasich. I've long been bullish on him for the reasons described. I think Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, has a lot going for him. He appeals to different constituencies that could do quite well. It'll be interesting to see how somebody like Carly Fiorina does as the only woman in the race. As you know, I don't think she's ultimately going to be the nominee, but she's been willing to go after Hillary Clinton most directly. She is not shy about taking on the former Secretary of State, Senator, and First Lady. So I would expect to see more fireworks coming from her. And the problem for all these candidates, though, is as long as Donald Trump is in the race and getting these headlines, it just blocks out virtually everything else they say and do.
Yes. Well, I'll go ahead and pass it back to Tim, and then I'm sure I have more questions as well. Tim?
Well, I'd like to jump over to the other side of the aisle and talk for just a moment about the Democratic field, which they can fit all of them on the stage. That won't be a problem there. A much more manageable field. We're sitting at 5 right now, and really we're sitting at 2. And in the long run, let's say Hillary Clinton does go on and get the Democratic nomination, as most people still expect. But in the long run, what will Bernie Sanders run or his insurgency do to her long term? Will it help or hurt, or will it not matter?
It's a bit hard to tell. I think it could potentially help in that it shines light on issues that resonate with a lot of people: income inequality, concern about stagnant wages, the so-called sharing economy, the use of contractors. These are issues that I think actually play to a lot of people's fears and concerns. Now, whether Bernie Sanders' prescriptions are the right ones, essentially democratic socialism, I have my doubts. I don't think that his answers, his policy solutions, probably have as much support, but I think he's really tapping into something that a lot of people feel strongly about. And so I think if she picks up on that, she can go a long way. Of course, he has the sincerity. This is something that he's been speaking about for 40 years. Plus, it's obvious he feels very strongly about this. With her, she kind of moves around, changes her views at different times. But I still think there's a chance to resonate with people on these issues that Bernie Sanders is raising so provocatively.
And what about this ongoing email controversy and all the haul-hauling out of Congress about the Benghazi hearings? And is it simply a political attack? And if it is, will it work?
Only if there's some blockbuster revelation that we haven't heard about yet. So far, the Clinton team has been quite effective in making this a story about the New York Times and putting the blame on their news gathering. This is a classic case of, you might say, spin manipulation, trying to make the story about the media, the reportage, rather than the facts at hand. So unless there is some new information, that revelation that comes out about what she did with her email systems, I'm skeptical it's going to hurt that much. People who are really mad about this probably are not going to vote for Hillary Clinton anyway. I think from what I hear, the Clinton campaign has kind of factored that in, saying essentially, you know what you get with us, and it's probably a wise strategy on their hand. So I think it's probably not going to be that big a deal in the end.
And now I want to jump one more time back over to good old Donald Trump, because let's face it, you just can't say enough about the guy. None of us can. And that is the possibility of him running as a third-party candidate. First of all, do you think that is a possibility? And secondly, is there any way he could do, say, as well as Ross Perot did in 1992 if he did run third party?
This has got to be Republicans' worst nightmare, that he truly comes in and siphons off some of that anti-establishment viewpoint that he maybe helps protect Hillary Clinton. This actually would be potentially a reason to deny Donald Trump a spot in the debate stages if he's not committed to the Republican Party. Of course, ultimately it's up to Fox News and Facebook to decide who gets in and who doesn't with these debates. I think it'd be really hard for an independent to have sway winning electoral votes. You saw Michael Bloomberg survey that kind of approach, and he's a lot richer than Donald Trump is, and he decided against it some years back. So I think it'd be awfully difficult to see what states Donald Trump could actually swing. He's probably not going to get more than 10% of the vote, but the guy's got such an ego, you never know what he's going to do. He'd have to spend a lot of money, of course, to get on the ballot, to hire lawyers, ballot access. It's doable, but it takes some planning ahead, and it depends how big his ego really is.
A bigger question about Donald Trump, and then I'll throw it back to David to carry us in another direction. He quite obviously is the top name in politics right now in this country. I mean, a case could be made for that, right? Just today, it's Donald Trump.
Sure.
And so then you have to look at who he is and you know, the ridiculousness of what he says and does. Where does the fault lie that Donald Trump is actually where he is in this race? Is it the fault of the American people? Is it the fault of the system? Is there some kind of major flaw that allows someone like him to be taken seriously? Or is it just that people are screaming, well, at least somebody's saying something, you know? What?
I think it's a combination of factors, the last one being the most important. That's what we write, the kind of thing we're trying to get at in this recent political language book, Dog Whistles, Washington, Walkbacks, and Washington Handshakes. I think people, I've long felt that people, a lot of voters out there, potential voters, would glom onto somebody who just told a trait. Maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong, but they don't like this double speak, dancing around things, this coded language. They just want straight talk and admission that sometimes the person doesn't have the answer, or it's just not something that can be split down the middle, etc. So I think that's what has a lot to do with it. Part of it is the anti-immigration feelings. Donald Trump, even though in the past he's had different views on this, anti-immigrant politics have been out there for most of the Republic, really going back at least to the 1850s or so, when it was a big part of the politics. It's always kind of been lurking under the surface, if not out there overtly. So I think it's a combination of things. It's his sheer force of personality. It's the fact that the rest of these candidates are, frankly, kind of stiffs. They're just like conventional politicians that work their way up. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but they work their way up from county executive to the state legislature to governor, or maybe state legislature to Congress, that sort of thing. Trump hasn't done any of that, and I think he's right. It's also a celebrity culture, and there's nobody better than building up their celebrity brand than Donald Trump.
Wow, excellent assessment. And with that, I'll throw it back to David.
Yes, well, let's talk about some more candidates, and one I want to talk about is Rand Paul. I think everybody thought, well, he'll probably get all of his father's movement, and he'll, because he's a senator, he'll add something to his father's movement because he's, you know, a little better known. But that hasn't been the case. I don't know if anybody has underwhelmed more than Rand Paul. I mean, do you kind of concur with that assessment, or do you see it differently?
Yeah, I would only add, I agree with all that, and I would just add, I thought the expectations of him were too high to begin with. The kind of libertarian conservatism he's pushing has a real limited audience in among Republican primary voters, particularly on foreign policy, which is anti-interventionist, basically pulling back, not having a particularly strong, assertive American foreign policy. That still doesn't go over well with a lot of Republican primary voters. And just look at how his father did when he ran for president for then Republican Congressman Ron Paul. He's just kind of, he got large crowds, kind of like Bernie Sanders is on the other side. But when it came to actually voting, I think the best he ever did was fifth place in New Hampshire. Maybe he did a little better in Iowa, but he was never remotely close to actually winning a contest. So even though Rand Paul, the senator, is a better politician, he's trying to nuance his positions more, I think there's a limited audience there, and I'd be surprised if he actually even makes it to the primaries, because don't forget, he's actually on the ballot again for his Senate seat in Kentucky. He's been trying to get the legislature there to change it so they can run for both offices. So far, that hasn't worked. So he's going to have to make a hard assessment relatively early on, whether he wants to go all in for the presidential race or try and hold on to his Senate seat. And Marco Rubio, another Republican candidate, I give him credit, whatever you think of his policies and views, he's giving up his Senate seat in order to make this presidential bid because his Senate seat is also up. And I think actually think that's the honorable thing to do, to pick one office or the other.
Yes, and obviously Florida will be a tougher state to hold it in. And then I think he's got more vice presidential possibilities than Rand Paul would. Well, let's talk about another candidate. That there's two ways to look at it. Jeb Bush, he's top three in every poll. You can say, hey, he's doing pretty well. But then if you look, a lot of times that number may be like 14 or 17. And he's running with the Bush name and been governor of Florida two terms and, you know, made some, you know, headlines in those terms. Why is he, or which way should we look at it? He's top three or he's just at 14?
No, I think he's definitely a top tier candidate. I've long been skeptical of his chances in that he's not actually that great of a retail politician. He's very much a policy wonk. Again, you might agree with him, you might not on policy, but he really knows his stuff. He studies it. He takes it quite seriously. As a candidate, he's okay. He appeals to a certain type of voter, and certainly with Latinos, he might do well because he's so good in Spanish and his family situation. But I think people that Bush fatigue is real. People don't want that dynastic aspect of it. It was one thing for the son of a former president to run. I wasn't crazy about that. It's not one thing for the wife of a former president. I'm not thrilled about that either. But to have another son go in there, it just seems, I think it's a bit much. And it's worth noting, Jeb Bush actually lost his first governor's race back in 1994. That was one of the best Republican years in decades. It was the best Republican year in decades. And the fact that he still couldn't close the deal then suggests he may be somewhat lacking as a candidate and retail politician.
Yes. Well, let me move back over this aisle. Bernie Sanders, I mean, he's obviously the not Hillary Clinton candidate. It seemed like there was a little room for one. There's a few more people running, but he's the only one to really garner any attention. But he's still, to this day, an independent. He's never, you know, run as a Democrat. Do you think a lot of Democrats will begin to have a problem with the fact that he's never run directly under the party banner, even though his ideology fits better, obviously, the Democrats and the Republicans?
Yeah, the problem with Bernie Sanders is he still appeals to a relatively narrow slice of the Democratic electorate, those who actually come out and vote in the primaries. He gets these big crowds in college towns and, you might say, older white liberal elites, to throw in some cliches there. But how he's going to play with rank-and-file union members, certainly with black voters, Hispanics, many others, I think he's got limited appeal there. So I think he's raising some important issues, and I can see why he's surging. But ultimately, I can also see why the Hillary Clinton campaign is kind of ignoring him, because I just think he's got limited selling points and viability among those who actually vote among Democratic primary base. But we'll see. And the fact that, yeah, he's been an independent all this time could hurt him. The only counter argument to that is he's always been open about his views. He says what he wants to make America more like Europe, like Sweden or Finland, a kind of a social democracy. And I think that goes a long way. People value that sincerity, even if they don't agree with it.
Yes. Tim, any more presidential questions before we move on?
Yeah, I got one. We've been talking a lot, you know, about things like the Confederate flag as a political issue on this program. And I got to thinking about third parties and their histories in this country. It seems that they've always done their best when they were headed up by a charismatic figure. And when that figure departed from the scene, then his movement, viable third party, come forth, say in the South, and rally around a cultural issue like the Confederate flag and be a viable party, or would they need that charismatic figure at the top to lead the way?
That's a great question, and that the more successful third party candidates in the last several decades were regional. Strom Thurmond and George Wallace. Unfortunately, with Thurmond, it was predicated explicitly on race, and with George Wallace, it was a strong undercurrent there. So hopefully, we wouldn't see something like that again. But yeah, you could. That's a great point. You could actually see something, particularly I think on issues like trade, manufacturing, something like that. People feel like their jobs are getting shipped overseas in South Carolina, or just to name one, many other parts of the country. So I think if they had a specific set of issues, that could help. But you hit the real problem with third parties in this country. The system just isn't set up to support one of these third parties beyond their charismatic leader. Then inevitably, those leaders depart from the scene, whether it's a Ross Perot or maybe now Donald Trump, whereas you have the staying power of the main parties. The Democratic Party is going to be around long after Barack Obama is president. You're going to have Republicans long after John Boehner isn't speaker. Like, there's a whole mechanism that's set up. With a third party, there isn't anything that to continue it. So I think it'd be really tough. Also, just to even win the electoral votes in a single state now would be difficult. Not impossible, but quite challenging.
Yeah, really. All right, one more presidential question, and I'll send it right back to David. We've heard much in recent years about the fabled blue wall of electoral politics. 242 electoral votes tied up for the Democrats in 18 states in the District of Columbia that they've won in each and every election in, I believe, the last six elections. Is that presently still holding?
Probably. It's a little difficult to say. And those are like you say, those are 242 electoral votes out of the 270 needed. The Democrats have won in six consecutive states. It's six consecutive races. It's hard to see any of those peeling back. The real problem that Republicans have is there's no margin for error. Democrats could actually forego the mega states of Ohio and Florida and still win if they can hold on to Colorado, Virginia, Nevada, New Mexico, New Hampshire, which they picked up in recent years. Or if they win Ohio and Florida, they can forego those other states. Whereas Republicans basically have to peel back Ohio and Florida and then still add on to some of those other states. So I think that blue wall is pretty strong. Nothing's impenetrable in Congress, in politics. These things change, coalitions can shift, but at this point, I think Democrats have a pretty strong built-in advantage, even with a mediocre candidate like Hillary Clinton is. And I say that as a campaigner. I'm not thinking into her policies, but even her strongest supporters would say that this isn't really her skill set, going around greeting voters the way that her husband did. But there's enough structural advantage there, she'll still probably win.
So let's take three states that generally are fought for. Pennsylvania, Ohio, Florida. What you're saying is the GOP really would have to win two of those three states, or the numbers just wouldn't be there, right?
Yeah, at least two of those three states, potentially all three, depending on what other states were involved. The thing about Pennsylvania is Republicans have made a strong play there in several of these recent presidential elections, and they still come up short. Just the Democratic base is so strong in the Philadelphia area and to a lesser degree in Pittsburgh that it usually offsets the more Republican regions. So if Republicans can act, the Republican nominee, whoever it is, actually can win Pennsylvania, then they've got a shot of picking up the presidency, because it probably means other states like, say, Michigan is turning, which, or at least is competitive, and who knows where else. But So that would be a real sign that things are potentially changing, but we'll have to wait and see on that one.
All right. I'll send it back to David now. David?
Yes. Well, Dave, Mark, we know that you have been writing a lot. Saw your website, saw you had published a lot of articles on the Christian Science Monitor. Tell our listeners, if they want to read your work, how to get to your website and other things you got coming up.
Yeah, best thing to do is just go to our book site, dogwhistlebook.com. It's related to our book, Dog Whistles, Walkbacks, and Washington Handshakes, Decoding the Jargon Sling and Bluster of American Political Speech. We post our recent articles up there, our appearances. We've got both got some coming up in various places in coming months, and we'll be writing a fair amount more as the election season really picks up going forward.
Yes. Now, you have a personal site, too, correct?
I do. Thank you. That's davidmark.org, where I also post all the articles that I write, not just with my co-author, but on my own as well. I had a recent one about Bernie Sanders and his religious background and various other pieces as well.
Yes. I just want to make sure I got that in, because I saw that, and it was funny. I could tell how much you had written recently. I thought, well, I'm going to see if the last time David was on here, and I clicked next page, next page, next page, and I was like, well, I'm just back to like May, and I've clicked it like five times, which just says how busy you are with so many, you know, so much writing. And so maybe this appearance will be just all, you know, no clickbacks, and I can and see it that way.
Well, I'm fortunate to be able to do it while I do some other editing to keep my in the day job for now. And it's fun to be a part of this the process.
Yes. Well, David, thanks again for being on the Kudzu Vine.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Thank you, sir.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, it's great to have David Mark on. You know, author, it works so many places, but davidmark.org, like he said, where you can get him. You can also at his book site, Dog Whistles, Walkbacks, and Washington Handshakes. He's been on just to talk about the book before when that came out. I guess we were on the book tour, so to speak, Tim. Well, been a big show. Really, I don't know with a minute and like 5 seconds if we can do any topic justice. You got a yes or no question for me, Tim?
Well, I got something to throw in. We were talking about this candidate and that candidate. I was looking at the Real Clear Politics general election matchups with all the big Republicans against Hillary Clinton. Guess which one runs closest to Hillary Clinton?
I'm just going to take a guess, Marco Rubio.
No, Dr. Paul. 4.4%, okay. And yet he has probably no chance to win the GOP nomination. As a matter of fact, I saw where his haul is $5 million in the last reporting period, and that's chicken feed, ain't it?
Yeah, well, love to see some cross tabs. Does he coalesce the libertarian vote better? I mean, why does that happen? I don't know, but that was unusual. I wouldn't have, if you would give me a second guess, he wouldn't have been my second guess. So you did stump me.
It is stunning, but there it is right in front of me.
Oh yeah. Well, been a great show. We hope next week Catherine will be feeling better and back with us. But I think we did an okay job just to tag team, right, Tim?
Yes, sir. And thank you, Mr. Mark, for being on with us tonight. You were terrific.
Oh, yes. Well, till next week, been the Kudzu Vine.
Good night.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.